one in that position of how do we understand peace? Is it subjugation that we're talking about? A subjugation to a certain version of neutrality that puts all of our lives in danger because we're facing an existential threat in the face of an entity that literally wants us all dead? And I think that's the question that's not being addressed. That's the question that's not being approached at all. And when it is, it's being approached in a very naive way. Like saying, oh, we do not accept anyone to use God's name to launch a war. Well, we're not launching a war in God's name. Mm-hmm. We are actually launching a defense in God's name. We are standing for the oppressed in God's name. We are facing, you know, killers in God's name.
An existential threat, literally an existential threat of everyone, especially the Christian communities in the areas that Zionist Israel is attempting to decimate. But unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I want to thank you very much, Miriam Sharabati, political commentator and writer, for joining us to talk about this, because it means a lot for the Christians of the East, where the Christians were, where their areas witnessed the birth and the life of Jesus Christ himself, to be literally left alone in the face of the Israeli aggression. Thank you very much for your time and your contribution, ladies and gents. Stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about Beijing's defiance in Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In Beijing, a village in southern Syria, civilians took a stand against an Israeli entity incursion, confronting occupation forces directly, even as airstrikes claimed the lives of entire families. Today we explore what this extraordinary act of grassroots resistance reveals about the readiness of the Syrian people to defend their land and the political vacuum left by the Julani regime's distancing from confronting Zionist Israel. More details in the following report.
Beijing has become yet another Syrian village forced to endure the fire of Zionist occupation. According to local witness accounts, early Friday dawned under the roar of tanks, helicopters, and fighter jets. An incursion by Israeli occupation forces into Beijing triggered a chain of events that ended with more than a dozen Syrians, including children, killed, dozens wounded, and entire families devastated. A patrol of Israeli occupation forces is said to have entered the town attempting arrests. Syrian sources reported that during the incursion, residents surrounded the patrol, resisting the attempt. In the ensuing exchange of fire, six soldiers were reportedly wounded. But the story did not end there. As the Israeli entity forces withdrew, they used artillery, drones, and air power to strike Beijing. That shelling and bombardment, indiscriminate, left at least 13 Syrians dead, including women and children, and dozens more wounded, some critically. Homes were destroyed, entire families wiped out, and a displaced community scattered. The government in Damascus swiftly condemned the raid as a war crime, a premeditated assault on civilians under the guise of a security operation. This is not merely a failed arrest operation gone wrong. For many observers, Beijing marks a turning point. Syrian civilians began resisting the occupation alone, without support from Damascus, signaling a new phase of grassroots armed defiance. If so, what does this mean for the future of the occupation and for the Syrian people's determination to defend their land? First, Beijing shows that occupation will never be accepted, not even under limited raids. Civilians fired back the moment soldiers crossed into their land. When the occupier traded dialogue for bombs, the price was devastating. This is clear evidence of a rising, popular, and decentralized Syrian resistance. Second, the brutal bombardment that followed local resistance exposes the occupier's weakness. When its ground forces falter, it turns to airstrikes and collective punishment, This pattern strips away any claim of self-defense. Third, Damascus condemned the attack but provided no real protection. For many in Beijing, this feels like abandonment, left to face raids, shelling, and insecurity alone. Beijing is more than a village. It's a warning to the occupier that even civilians will resist, to nearby regimes that silence will not be forgotten, and to the world that violence against civilians only strengthens the will to resist, not break it. For Syrians, Beijing will long be etched into memory, a martyrdom, a tragedy, but also a declaration. Land, dignity, and resistance belong together.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hassan Hijazi, political commentator, expert in Zionist affairs. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Hijazi. Now, how does the popular resistance in Beijing in Syria, where civilians confronted Israeli occupation forces and really paid a heavy price, redefine the balance of power on the ground in southern Syria? What does this really tell us about the limits of Zionist Israel's incursions in Syria?
There is no doubt that this confrontation reflects a turning point in the Syrian landscape within the areas occupied and repeatedly violated by the Israeli entity. Since the fall of the former Syrian regime, there had been no real state of popular resistance, largely due to the dire circumstances faced by the Syrian people emerging from a long and devastating internal war. But it now appears that this phase is witnessing the formation of local groups willing to fight, no longer prepared to accept a situation in which occupation forces carry out daily incursions and dozens of assaults on Syrian villages in the buffer zone and the areas north of it. The occupation has effectively transformed southern Syria into an open zone of operations where it acts freely, as though there were no people, no state, and no trace of Syrian sovereignty. This reality has deeply provoked Syrians. The escalation in targeted attacks, raids, arrests, and humiliations inflicted on Syrians in those areas has generated a strong popular backlash, expressed repeatedly through protests and other forms of civil resistance. But today's scene goes further. It confirms a state of mounting anger and intense resentment toward the occupation, with tensions reaching a point where Syrian civilians themselves have taken up arms to confront the Zionist soldiers. This development underscores how the occupation continues to escalate day after day through assassinations, raids, and violations, attempting by various means to impose security dominance and assert a supposed right to infiltrate and operate within these regions, under the pretext of arrangements previously discussed with the Syrian side. This behavior reflects the extent of Zionist arrogance and overreach, showing complete disregard for the sovereignty of neighboring states, international law, and the basic rights of people living in these areas. The occupation acts as though it is entitled to violate these lands and terrorize their inhabitants. But it seems this era is reaching its end. Syrians are no longer willing to remain silent. They will confront this Israeli entity escalation with force and resolve.
Despite that, Mr. Hassan, the Jolani regime in Damascus appears eager to pursue some sort of a rapprochement with Zionist Israel through the so-called Abraham Accords, rather than actually support the local resistance in southern Syria. How does this political stance affect the morale and the strategic capabilities of Syrian civilians defending their own land because they are left alone?
In truth, any form of resistance requires two essential factors. The first relates to popular support, and this seems to be emerging in the reality of southern Syria. The recent clash and the widespread denunciation it sparked clearly reflect this growing base of support. However, the official position of the Syrian government, including the government of Ahmed al-Sharaa, continues to lean toward negotiation. Since the first day it assumed authority in Damascus, the Sharaa administration declared that it had only one option: settlement, peace, and the accompanying slogans. This reality suggests that Syrian parties seeking to confront the occupation must have political backing inside Damascus, a supportive political front that empowers resistance to become a legitimate option for the Syrian people, both at the popular and official levels. Persisting in the path of settlements, contemplating joining the Abraham Accords, and seeking security arrangements with the occupation have all proven to be ineffective approaches that will neither restore Syrian rights nor expel the occupier. The situation mirrors that of the Palestinians. The occupier openly declares it will not withdraw from the areas it recently seized, particularly the summit of Mount Hermon on the Syrian side. Add to this its insistence on retaining full freedom of movement, and its demand that the United States guarantee in any future agreement the right to strike any target it wishes inside Syria. Without a firm and unwavering official stance capable of confronting these demands, the occupation will attempt to cement these violations into permanent facts on the ground, granting itself the supposed right to continue this level of aggression on Syrian territory.
Well, Mr. Hijazi, looking forward to what has happened, what lessons can be drawn from Beijing for the broader Syrian struggle against the Zionist occupation, which, as you said, wants to remain in Mount Hermon? Does this even signal some sort of a new decentralized form of resistance capable of challenging occupation without even relying on state support?
لا شك أن حالة المقاومة تتماهى عن الموقف الرسمي عموماً يعني في تجربة المقاومة.
There is no doubt that resistance movements often diverge from official state positions. In the early experiences of popular resistance, whether in Syria, Palestine, or Lebanon, these formations arose from the will of the people, independent of official institutions. When states themselves enter into direct confrontation, it can actually limit the effectiveness of the resistance, because the occupation can pressure governments by targeting their assets, infrastructure, and institutions. Relying on popular momentum grants the resistance far greater freedom of movement and protects it from being tied to political agendas or constraints imposed on the government in Damascus. A resistance movement built on popular forces, on capabilities that do not necessarily stem from official structures, can continue and grow, especially if there is genuine will among the Syrian people, among numerous organizations, parties, and military or political groups capable of taking on such a role without requiring full and formal endorsement from the authorities. Yet even in such a scenario, the state cannot oppose such resistance, for it is exercising a legitimate right, the right to self-defense, the right to defend sovereignty, and the right to confront an occupation that violates borders for no reason whatsoever. There is no justification for the occupation's presence in southern Syria. There is no justification for its arrests, assassinations, and repeated violations, except for the lies propagated by Israeli entity propaganda. We are, in fact, witnessing a landscape that suggests new horizons, a profound sense of hope that a significant awakening is emerging in southern Syria, where groups are forming to confront the occupation. I believe this path will yield positive results for Syrians. It will force the occupation to reassess its calculations carefully and may eventually push it to retreat from the areas it has seized and to put an end to its daily aggressions.
But the interesting part, Mr. Hassan, is that we heard the official Syrian regime's statements saying that they would urge the so-called international community to make Israel stop its aggression. This is the same thing that we hear here in Lebanon. It's the same statements that are being said by officials, but the people are not being helped. They are being left alone. So do they have the capabilities to fight against Zionist Israel?
In truth, putting aside the official position, which has come to rely on options that have proven ineffective, the popular reality is different. Yes, Syrians suffer from many crises. They face severe economic, social, and military challenges, especially after the Israeli entity destroyed much of the Syrian army's capabilities. But a popular resistance movement does not require extensive resources. A small amount of equipment, paired with the will to resist, is enough to build a formidable resistance experience, one capable of posing a significant challenge to the occupation. Ultimately, the matter hinges on popular will, on the readiness to confront and sacrifice in order to achieve the desired outcomes.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, political commentator, expert in Zionist affairs, for joining us to talk about the pressing matter of southern Syria against the Zionist Israeli entity's incursions. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we are with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of chapter Ankabut. Dear brothers and sisters, we have reached the 40th verse of Surah Ankabut.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فَكُلًّا أَخَذْنَا بِذَنْبِهِ فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِ حَاصِبًا وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَخَذَتْهُ الصَّيْحَةُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ خَسَفْنَا بِهِ الْأَرْضَ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَغْرَقْنَا وَمَا كَانَ اللَّهُ لِيَظْلِمَهُمْ وَلَكِنْ كَانُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ.
So each we seized for his sin, and among them were those upon whom we sent a storm of stones, and among them were those who were seized by the blast from the sky, and among them were those whom we caused the earth to swallow, and among them were those whom we drowned. And Allah would not have wronged them, but it was they who were wronging themselves.
So, as you listen to the verse, in this holy verse, the Almighty Allah starts saying, فَكُلًّا أَخَذْنَا بِذَنْبِهِ. So each of them we seized in punishment for his sin. So as you were with us in the previous episodes, and in the 39th verse specifically, we discussed the ending state of وَقَارُونَ وَفِرْعَوْنَ وَهَامَانَ. That's what the verse said. The ending of Qarun, Pharaoh, and Haman was that the Almighty Allah destroyed them all. So this verse continues, فَكُلًّا أَخَذْنَا بِذَنْبِهِ. And each of them we seized in punishment for his sin. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِ حَاصِبًا. And one of them, against some, we sent a violent tornado. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَخَذَتْهُ الصَّيْحَةُ. Some were caught by a mighty blast. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ خَسَفْنَا بِهِ الْأَرْضِ. And some, we caused the earth to swallow up. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَغْرَقْنَا. And some, we drowned. وَمَا كَانَ اللَّهُ لِيَظْلِمَهُمْ. It was not Allah to do injustice to them. وَلَكِنْ كَانُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ. That's the point. They were doing injustice unto themselves. So, the point is, we must not become proud when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us respite. since the end of sin is retribution, and it is easy for Allah to punish us with kinds of punishment. Because the previous verse said, وَمَا كَانُوا صَابِقِينَ, they could not overreach us. They could not escape from the grips of the Almighty Allah. So in this verse, He subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَكُلًّا أَخَذْنَا بِذَنْبِهِ. Indeed, since there were mentioned four groups in the previous two verses, whose punishments were not mentioned there, the people of Ad, the people of Thamud, Qarun, Pharaoh and Haman, in this verse, their chastisement are stated sequentially. So it says, and of them, against some we sent a violent tornado. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِ حَاصِبًا. The Quranic word hasib means a violent wind, bringing with it a shower of stones. That's the meaning of it. So hasban means some pebbles in Arabic. But the objective of meaning, the objective of actually mentioning this group is the people of Ad. That according to different chapters of the Quran, like Dhariyat, like other chapters like Qamar, a violent or harsh wind came over them for 7 nights and 8 days, and it ruined their houses and threw their corp here and there like the leaves of the trees in fall. So that's the ending of only one group. What will happen to the next? So anyway, after this verse mentioned the ending of the people of Ad, فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِ حَاصِبًا, we move on to the next group. The verse continues saying, وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَخَذَتْهُ الصَّيْحَةً, and some were caught up by a mighty blast. We have said that the heavenly blast is the result of thunderbolts, which are usually accompanied with earthquake at the center of its occurrence. And this was the chastisement which came down upon the people of Thamud. Yes, the people of Thamud and other people like people of Thamud. That's their ending. And this was the punishment with the Qarun. What was it? وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ خَسَفْنَا بِهِ الْأَرْضِ. This is the third chastisement. We caused the earth to swallow up him, actually. To swallow up Qarun is his punishment. That was his punishment. The rich, proud, arrogant Qarun from the children of Israel. Finally, Allah drowns some others. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَغْرَقْنَا. And some of them we drowned. We know that this meaning is pointing to Pharaoh, Haman, and their followers, which has been mentioned in different chapters of the Quran, and that's how we know it actually. However, keeping this statement in mind, the above four chastisements are sequentially for the four evil groups whose deviation and sins were mentioned in the previous verses. But for an emphasis upon this fact, that they got the result of their own deeds and actually reaped the product of the seeds of which they themselves have scattered, the end of the verse with actually explicit attention says, ولكن وما كان الله ليظلمهم. Don't you think that Allah does injustice to them? ولكن كانوا أنفسهم يظلمون. They unto their own selves were doing injustice. So the punishments in this world and the next world are some reactions. These punishments in the next world are the embodiments of man's deeds. And actually, that's how the Almighty Allah mentions it. So the belief of the followers of the school of fatalism, who also exist among some Muslims, is made futile by this strong logic of the Quran. Why? Because this verse clearly strengthens the principle of freedom of will in mankind and makes this fact fully clear that making decision everywhere and for everything belongs to man himself alone and no one else. And Allah has created him free, and Allah has wanted him to be free, actually. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode as well. We took great help from the enlightening commentary Into the Light of the Holy Quran, available in the website al-islam.org. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins. You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh, Father, we love. Your door, and you give him your necklace and the only food in your home. You talk to God until the rising of the sun, and you forget yourself while praying.
if we were able to target cancer cells directly without affecting the healthy tissue surrounding it? Well, that's exactly what the scientists here at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran have been able to do using yttrium-90. So in this week's episode of Iran Tech with me, your host Ali Reza, we're going to dive deep into how yttrium-90 can be used to target cancer cells in the liver directly without affecting the healthy tissue surrounding it. Stay tuned. Clarify something first. When I say liver cancer, I don't mean just the type of cancer that the cancer tumors that originate from within the liver. I also mean other types of cancers that have metastasized, and you can find the metastasized cancer tumors inside the liver as well, which actually makes up the majority of liver cancer cases. And treating liver cancer has been traditionally difficult using surgery and chemotherapy because only about 30% of actual patients qualify to get these treatments. And, you know, speaking of the treatments, chemotherapy itself is unpleasant, and we all know it. You lose body hair, your body is weak. There's plenty of reasons to try to avoid it if you can. And you can using this groundbreaking technology. Microspheres that contain yttrium-90, these tiny glass beads with this radioactive isotope, the radioisotope of yttrium, not the neutral yttrium-89, the radioactive one, yttrium-90. So you can inject these tiny glass beads into the bloodstream, into the blood supply of the cancer tumors, and it can selectively, using selective internal radiation therapy, SIRT, it can target those cancer cells directly and, you know, leave everything else untouched. So this is how yttrium-90 can help treat liver cancer. So first, we're going to learn about how it's made, and then we're going to take a closer look at how it works.
Our particle manufacturing process as microspray involves several stages. To create the particle, we first combine the raw materials and form a suspension. We then synthesize them using the Sol-Gel method to achieve the desired chemical composition. After completing the Sol-Gel process, the next step is drying to obtain the target powder. Subsequently, to achieve the intended structural properties, biocompatibility, and a specific characteristic termed PATL, the synthesized powder undergoes heat treatment at a controlled temperature. Following this, the sample is milled, and the insert process, a term used for spheroidization, is performed to shape the particles into spheres. Once spheroidization is complete, the particles are spherical, but exhibit a broad size distribution, ranging from approximately 15 to 20 micrometers. However, the final product requires particles between 10 to 20 micrometers. To achieve this, we perform particle size classification using mechanical sieving, mechanical screening. After sieving, quality control, QC, is conducted under a microscope. The particles are then sterilized, packaged into specialized vials, and sent for irradiation.
These microspheres, these tiny glass beads that contain yttrium-90, they need to be a very specific size, between 20 to 40, 50 microns. So basically thinner than a hair strand. And they need to be exactly that size or exactly within that range, because if they are too small, then they could essentially seep into other organs of the body. If they are too big, they will just get lodged into the main vessel that is going into the liver. So it needs to be, the size needs to be just right. So once they are injected, they'll essentially lodge themselves around the area where the cancer tumor is getting fed from the blood supply. And they start emitting beta rays that start to shrink the cancer tumor by destroying the DNA of the cancer tumor. And that way, it'll gradually shrink down and get replaced by healthy cells to the point that we can hopefully say that the cancer tumor is essentially gone. And it's compared to the typical external radiation methods, you know, you have to do multiple hospital visits, whereas this is a one-time injection, which is also a lot more precise, hence the selective internal radiation therapy, SIRT. So we're going to take a closer look at how this process works first, and then talk about the broader implications of it.
The patient is first prepared with mild sedation and local anesthesia at the groin. A small incision is made to allow insertion of a catheter into the femoral artery. Using real-time imaging, the catheter is carefully navigated through the arterial network until it reaches the hepatic artery, the main vessel supplying the liver. At this point, a carefully measured suspension of yttrium-90 loaded glass microspheres is injected directly into the hepatic artery. These microspheres, each between 20 and 50 microns in diameter, travel with the bloodstream until they lodge in the tiny arterioles feeding the tumor. Their small size ensures that they preferentially accumulate in the tumor's vascular bed while bypassing much of the healthy tissue. Once the microspheres are in place, they begin to emit beta radiation. This form of radiation penetrates only a few millimeters, targeting the tumor cells while largely sparing the surrounding healthy liver tissue. The beta particles disrupt the DNA within cancer cells, impairing their ability to divide and triggering cell death. This localized radiation gradually shrinks the tumor over several days, as the continuous emission of energy damages the cancer cell's structural integrity. The entire injection process typically takes between 60 to 90 minutes. In the days following the treatment, the microspheres continue to emit radiation, steadily damaging the tumor from within. Throughout this process, the targeted nature of the therapy minimizes systemic side effects typically seen with the traditional chemotherapy or external radiation. By concentrating the therapeutic effects directly at the tumor site, normal liver function is largely preserved, and patients often experience a significant improvement in their quality of life. The precision of this treatment reduces complications and supports a quicker recovery, allowing patients to resume their normal activities sooner. This method represents a significant advance in the treatment of liver cancer, offering a minimally invasive alternative that delivers high doses of radiation directly to the tumor while minimizing exposure to healthy tissues.
It is important to note that the yttrium or Newell glass microspheres injected into patients are biocompatible. The particle size for these microspheres is within the 40 to 50 micron range. Particles smaller than 50 microns risk passing through hepatic capillaries and leaking into the lungs. Particles larger than 50 microns avoid this issue, as they do not migrate from blood vessels into the liver mass. Due to these critical size-dependent effects, strict quality control, QC testing, is performed on the particles to ensure their size falls within the specified range.
The yttrium glass microspheres discussed here are not our primary focus. However, they represent the latest achievement of the radiotherapy equipment research laboratories at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute and are classified as medical devices. This technology serves as a non-surgical alternative for inoperable tumors, either as a standalone treatment or in combination with chemotherapy. A key advantage of this method over conventional radiotherapy is its ability to spare healthy liver tissues, which are highly sensitive to radiation, thereby minimizing adverse side effects. We selected a product with a 100-day time frame to enable faster commercialization and market readiness. Currently, our laboratory focuses on producing internal radiotherapy products, including brachytherapy techniques. These are targeted therapeutic methods capable of localized treatment of tumor tissues. Producing these devices positions us as a regional hub for advancing medical tourism, It is worth noting that our laboratory is the only active facility in the country and the broader region, excluding Russia, specializing in the production of medical radioactive sources. This grants us significant potential in medical tourism. The production of yttrium-90 glass microspheres has already been successfully implemented at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute. The pilot scale production stages are now complete. The animal phase has been completed, and all necessary tests, including toxicity, dimensional, and density tests, which are specific to the production process, have been conducted. The physical parameters of the product align with those of commercial sources, and from our perspective, this phase is fully accomplished. However, to enter the market, it was imperative to conduct the clinical phase to determine the product's efficacy. We are currently carrying out the clinical phase in collaboration with Shahid Beheshti, University of Medical Sciences. Approximately 20 patients have been treated with this product so far. Initial results reported by the treating physicians have been satisfactory, meeting the parameters we prioritize, such as absence of toxicity, no leakage to other organs, and concentration in liver tissue. These outcomes have been observed and documented in several early-stage treatment cases. Indeed, the preliminary results have been declared promising. These results may include reductions in tumor size, tumor necrosis, decreased vascularization, diminished blood supply to the tumor tissue, and I would like to highlight reduced metabolic activity within the tumor area. Fortunately, the outcomes thus far have been encouraging. God willing, upon completing the clinical phase and analyzing the results, we will proceed to secure the required permits from the Ministry of Health, Treatment, and Medical Education to introduce this product to the market and commence its commercial distribution.
Today we showed you how our scientists are working hard to cause a breakthrough and sort of a revolution in liver cancer treatment in Iran using these microspheres that contain yttrium-90, the radioisotope of yttrium, which, fun fact, is actually being produced inside this nuclear power reactor because you need a reactor to create radioisotopes. And we're waiting for the final stages of the clinical trials to get the approval to be able to produce it at scale, to become only the second country in the world to be able to produce these yttrium-90 radioisotopes at scale for commercial use. So we're hoping for that to happen sooner rather than later. And with that said, we've come to the end of this episode of Iran Sig.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Let's listen to it. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, that is the actual word of God, the Quran is the holiest book for Muslims, literally meaning the recitation. The Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which is consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we go for the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment, you alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. They will be followed by Minbar. The program covers speeches on various subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Then it's time for our varied radio productions feature. And our final program this hour is Quran Quest. If you want to know more about the Holy Quran, then this program is definitely for you. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Pero paz con soberanía.
We want peace, but peace with sovereignty, peace with equality, peace with freedom. We do not want the peace of slaves, nor do we want the peace of colonies. Never colonies, never slaves.
The statements by the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro Moros, are in response to the multiple attacks facing the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro was addressing crowds of his supporters outside the presidential palace in Caracas. He warned that Venezuela will resist any attempt to impose a political change by force. Meanwhile, the national government denounced the theft of Citgo Petroleum Corporation by a U.S. court, together with sectors of the Venezuelan extreme right, as part of an operation to plunder the assets of the Venezuelan people.
La empresa Citgo es un valioso.
Citgo is a valuable asset of Petróleos de Venezuela, which the U.S. government intends to plunder by means of legal proceedings that are clearly contrary to law.
De un procedimiento judicial.
Precisely, the Venezuelan government previously denounced before OPEC that the Trump administration is attempting to provoke regime change in order to seize its assets and oil reserves, the largest in the world. For this reason, the National Assembly defends the national sovereignty over this resource and its industry.
But we in this caucus, all the parliamentarians here are going to vote in favor of this draft agreement because when the homeland is in danger, anything is permitted except not defending it.
The amount of resources that have been plundered from the country cannot be described at this time.
Parliamentarians, in line with the government and its defense of natural resources, approved this draft agreement that condemns the theft from the people orchestrated by the most radical and submissive opposition, as well as by the United States government and its multiple attacks on the Bolivarian Republic.
From all instances, Venezuela stands resolute to maintain its independence and to preserve its resources. Those are the premises that are the cornerstone of the Bolivarian Revolution and the current policies by the government facing new forms of attacks. Gladys Quesada, Caracas, Venezuela.
Today is the third and final day of that judicial review in this court. It's in fact a legal challenge brought by the direct action group Palestine Action against its prescription by the Labor government in July this year. Last month, the judges heard from the representatives of the Palestine Action group, but today, the final day, the judges are hearing from lawyers representing the Interior Ministry, known to Britons as the Home Office. But here's how we got here.
Set up in 2020, Palestine Action's stated goal is to end global participation in Israel's genocidal and apartheid regime. It's mainly targeted weapons factory, especially those belonging to the Israeli group Elbit Systems. In July this year, activists protesting against Israel's genocidal war on Gaza broke into an Air Force base in southern England, causing, the government claims, more than $9 million in damage to two aircraft. Days later, then-Home Secretary Yvette Cooper declared the group a terrorist entity, effectively making membership or support for the group a criminal offense. The ban took effect in July 5th.
It's a massive, massive overreaction and, frankly, an act of state repression to stop the people from mobilizing in a way that they feel is detrimental to their financial interests.
Seeing this as an attack on their civil liberties, thousands have since come out in a string of rallies, holding up signs reading these words. At least 2,300 have been arrested, more than 200 charged with offenses that carry up to 6 months in prison. Earlier this year, Palestine Action's co-founder, Huda Amouri, requested and won permission for a judicial review of the ban at this court, for the court to see if the ban was lawful, if the Home Office followed the correct procedure before proceeding to proscribe the group. In October, the government tried and failed to block the challenge going ahead. And last month, after days of nationwide sign-holding protests, the judicial review finally began. But at the last minute, Martin Chamberlain, the judge due to hear the legal challenge, was replaced by a panel of three judges without explanation. Two of those replacement judges have links that campaigners say raise the appearance of a conflict of interest.
The case against some of the most formidable foes in the world, the British state, the Israeli state, the weapons industry, these are not people who are going to take this lightly. So it doesn't surprise me that they're willing to sabotage the process.
Dame Victoria, who has familial links to prominent pro-Israel lobbyist and major Labour Party donor Trevor Chin, and the group Quilliam, which has been widely condemned as Islamophobic and for supporting far-right agitator Tommy Robinson. And Justice Jonathan Swift, who dismissed WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange's extradition appeal back in 2023, has represented the Home Office, which is the defendant in this judicial review, on more than one occasion.
A judgment is expected at a later date, but if the judges in this court find in favor of Palestine Action, the group could potentially be deprescribed. The charges against its many supporters will have to be dropped, and not only that, it'll be a huge embarrassment for the British government that the pro-Palestine demonstrators in the country accuse of participation in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians. Saipur is up, London.
Pakistan's Defense Minister Khwaja Asif has said that Muslim countries should revisit their diplomatic stance on Gaza, arguing that incessant Israeli ceasefire violations have undermined peace efforts. His comments come as several regional governments express frustrations over the failure of internationally backed agreements to halt military operations. Officials in Islamabad say any reassessment would aim to push for a more reliable framework that prevents future breaches. The idea of a collective Muslim response has been gaining traction in recent weeks, particularly as the Gaza humanitarian concerns deepen.
Daily ceasefire violations are occurring by the Israeli forces, and Muslim Ummah needs to be united and have one solution with one voice, but they are not raising their voices against the Israelis.
Countries across West Asia have been consulting one another on possible political steps, including coordinated pressure through regional bodies. Observers say the broader question is whether Muslim-majority states can unify around a position strong enough to influence future negotiations. Pakistan's call reflects a wider debate over the limits of current mediation efforts. They point out any new approach would require consensus among key regional actors and a clearer mechanism for enforcing commitments on all sides and a more sustainable political roadmap for Gaza.
What will Israel do? Will it continue to violate the ceasefire? This is an existential question for all the countries who have agreed to this U.S.-backed solution. How long will they allow Israel to kill innocent Palestinian children? No, they will reconsider.
The debate points to a wider re-evaluation underway throughout the Muslim world, suggesting that Gaza's future may hinge on a new coordinated regional strategy that could reshape the way the conflict is addressed. Khanwa Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
The UN General Assembly officially established International Solidarity Day in 1977 to express its concern about the continuing plight of the Palestinian people.
Despite the ceasefire, it is still an ongoing genocide. So the special thing is we're trying to bring to the attention of the international community about the plight of the Palestinian people, not only the genocide in Gaza, but also the terror of the settlers in the West Bank.
Speakers stressed that the Palestinian people have not yet achieved their inalienable right as defined by the General Assembly, namely the right to self-determination and national independence, among other things.
The occupation has no moral limits, but during the past 2 years, the Palestinian people have shown their resistance, which made Israel a pariah state. This is what we celebrate on this day. The project for Palestinian nationhood will not come to an end because the Arab states support it.
Representatives and ambassadors from dozens of UN member states expressed their support for Palestine, while many criticized UN Security Council for its inaction to end the Gaza genocide. On November 17th, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2803, which endorsed US President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza.
The document contains several deeply problematic elements. Israel's obligations as an occupying power, including the renunciation of annexation of Palestinian lands and the withdrawal of its forces, are not enshrined. Resolution 2803, adopted by the UN Security Council, does not vest it with the necessary prerogatives to maintain peace and security.
The United Nations Security Council, which would have the powers and the authority to take coercive measures against such extreme violations of international order and international law, has been paralyzed because what is written in its own charter, namely the veto right. In this particular case of mainly, not only, but mainly, I mean the veto privilege enjoyed by the United States.
The Day of Solidarity at UN concluded with a cultural program featuring the Palestinian choir, Shatat, screenings of Gaza documentaries and Palestinian cuisine.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at UN headquarters in Vienna concludes a series of events and demonstrations over the past days and weeks. Cultural events, diplomatic meetings and protests were well attended by representatives and people from around the world. However, diplomats from Western states remained largely absent from any shows of solidarity with the Palestinians. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
On the second leg of his first foreign trip as head of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV is in Lebanon for a visit, which he said carries a message of peace.
At times, humanity looks at the Middle East with a sense of trepidation and disheartenment in the face of such complex and long-standing conflicts. Yet in the midst of these struggles, a sense of hopefulness and encouragement can be found when we focus on what unites us, our common humanity, and our belief in a God of love and mercy.
During an interreligious event at Martyrs Square in central Beirut, the Pope listened to representatives from many of Lebanon's 18 officially recognized religious denominations. The Shia cleric asked the Pope to advocate for an end to Lebanon's years-long struggle in the face of Israeli aggression.
We are believers of the significance of the authority of the state.